Thank you. that bad thing.
Is that all come from the room today?
No.
This is a call from Stephen Sonnen.
From?
Stephen Sonnen.
And he's up to 60 for our pollution.
Usually some of the forms of science, technology, and the division of the world.
Are you concerned to you or the industry?
Is that something or something that
you think? You guys are playing, is it something?
But you don't know what you're doing in the industry. You know, the CEO is going to tell us what you're doing.
I'm working in the office of the studio.
Executive Director, Service Delivery.
Oh, I see. That's a very important.
My name is Quentin McCoy, sir. I'm the Executive Director for the Demographic Development Program.
Dr. Fagin, Director of Climate and Technology.
Or the Office of CFO and
Service. Jay Liddy, Executive Director of the Program Education Science.
What are you doing?
I'm working in the social impact chief
director. I'm David Markola. I'm currently acting as a chief operating officer and technology.
Ismail Hussain from the Parliamentary Monitoring Group.
Okay, thank you very much. Without taking time, let's give the introduction to Lila with the presentation.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. The report this year is really focused on the area of social and human sciences that is in which and improve the quality of life of all South Africans as well as the mother continent. What I've tried to do, very briefly, I've tried to cut a presentation of 1 hour and try to do it in 20 minutes. So, because of the other meetings, but we'll touch on the question of the purpose of this report, the financial position of the organization, and we'll highlight some of the studies that are conducted, and that's where we might be able to cut on some of the studies. And then we get a question that falls for the HSRC over the last financial year. In terms of our purpose, in line with our desire to really contribute to the national and global knowledge creation, our performance in the past year, Honorable Chairperson, has been phenomenal. We've conducted 188 research projects in areas that affect people on a daily basis. In terms of the financial position of the HSRC, we achieved a turnover of 325.3 million. And that is much higher compared to 251.6 million that we achieved in 2007-08. This higher turnover of the HSRC is really representing a huge increase of about 24% or 64 million rand, you know, from the previous financial year. And the external research income was quite large. It was 150. We got more money coming in from outside than, you know, external that's coming domestically. And the parliamentary grant also, I must say, contributed significantly to the financial, good financial position, you know, of the HSRC. The income from the international sources, as I indicated, is high, with, you know, 76% of the total external research income that we receive. This slide is just showing us a little bit about how the money that we get and how we spend it. So if you look at it, you see that HSRC income has grown significantly from FY01-02 to 08-09. As you can see, it's really the highest. But what's good is that whatever it is you get, we actually spend. many of them were very good at social capacity. It's an indicator of having really highly skilled people that are capable of utilizing the resources that they have. It means that they're managing properly and they're able to use that, those resources, you know, very well. The research team for the HSRC that we are talking about today is the gathering with society, which is looking at the whole section of education and science and world of work and HIV and health systems and then policy and development. Let me say, because of the time frame, we will not be able to give you a whole lot more than what is contained in the report that we have. So you'll be able to study it carefully after the meeting of the report that is being tabled. I just mentioned the fact that you received two copies of the report. The only thing is just one figure, you know, in the financial statement, if you want to make sure that it's correct. But the bulk of it, you know, almost all of it is actually, you should not get too worried so much about it. Let me start with the governance of society. And just simply say to you that we've undertaken a whole lot of research in this particular area. And that kind of research has focused on reasons why some people commit violent crimes, we look at how crime affects individuals and communities, we look at the attitude of South Africans who are foreigners, and also we look at an attempt to understand the reasons for the xenophobic and homophobic attacks. I'm afraid that the xenophobic violence is also kind of banked in the contract of the society. In terms of the crime, you know, related issues, we have been looking at major concerns about, you know, people feeling safe. Many people are feeling that they are not very safe because our country is great with crime. I mean, we must accept that, but we do have a serious problem of crime. We all live behind fences. We all live. Sometimes I kind of feel like we ourselves are not as free as the criminal. The criminal seems to be in our own house. And research has been done to try to understand, you know, this whole issue. And I must say that the studies actually concern the deep seated fears about personal and community safety, and that continues to be shared by a really large proportion of South Africans across the different social economic groups and across the different demographic spectrums. And because of this fear, it exerted an influence on confidence in the police force, in the demand for public safety, you know, also social connections, as well as personal well-being. And of course, the limited access to protecting the democratic system. As a result of all of this, the research has recommended that identifying, testing, and evaluating strategies for reducing fear of crime should actually be recognized as a priority alongside that of reducing, you know, crime itself. I have touched on now very briefly on the question of education, science, and skills development. This is a key issue. I mean, on education and science, and this is a key issue that is affecting us in South Africa. And by that, I mean the quality of education. The education and science area, we really are concerned about quality of education that actually needs to be addressed. We conducted some of the studies in the classroom, having set up the normal for assessment for their lab, and looking at the question of any child the development and examining reasons for why there's such a low throughput at universities. We conducted this particular study, which was recognized by our former Minister of Finance, Cheba Manyo, when he gave a speech, you know, at the annual TV Commemorial Service. And he said, you know, the work of the HSRC on quality education is really a good one. Each year, when the test results are issued, the media focus on the schools that have produced excellent results as well as schools where the results leave much to be desired. He said the HSRC has a unit whose sole job is to try to understand what works in driving school performance. And instead of that, this researcher finds poor schools with good results and studies them in fine detail. In almost all cases where poor schools have done excellent work, there are three factors that stand out. The first one being the presence of a competent and dedicated school principal, and the second one being teachers who are dedicated, prepared, and spend long hours with the learners, and thirdly, the schools that have developed solid relationships with parents and communities in which they are located. So these are the key things that, you know, our researchers have been able to identify, and they frequently feed that information to our policymakers so that they can be able to take this information and implement some of the recommendations. The next issue that I'd like to address is the question of the world of work. Here, we must remember that the poor quality of education, it actually contributes to the shortage of skills, which are crucial to the management of various aspects of our economy. Now, we at the Asian Society, together with our partners in academic institutions and non-governmental organizations, have been at the forefront of conducting research that focuses on skills development, on skills shortage, and on skills retention, as well as the core question of how you grow them. Now, the work of this Asian Society really focuses on the extent to which workers acquire skills. It focuses on the question of unemployed youth, to see where do they change, and also to look at whether after training they get employed or not, or what strategies to actually be utilized. And then it also looks at who are the designated groups that have benefited from the Department of Labor's Employment Equity Program. And that work was recognized by the Minister of Labor, who said that, you know, over the last 2 years, the action was very hard with the Asian Society. The Asian Society has produced about 45 reports which covered various areas. And what was interesting is that, and I quote the Minister of Labor on October 2008, he says, "The Asian Society produced no less than 45 reports covering various topics and presented us with evidence of some of the issues. They have also criticized us in those areas that we fell short, pointed out those areas that we can still improve upon, and also made a series of recommendations." That is very encouraging, coming in, you know, from the ministry, indicating the fact that they do use the evidence that actually comes out of the research that the ministry does. The next issue that we need to touch on, which is a closely related challenge to shortage skills, is the question of employment creation. We are aware of the very, very high rate of unemployment in South Africa. The global economic crisis has actually exacerbated the already serious problems that we're experiencing. And there's a need really for innovative job creation. Now, the employment creation work is done by a unit called the Center of Excellence in Employment Creation. We created this particular area so that we can be able to work very closely with the Twali municipality. And they gave us funds over a 3-year period to say, look at the question of employment through procurement. Look at the question of employment for any child with development for children under 5, and look at enhancing the employability, you know, of school leavers. Now, our job here is to come up with innovative approaches of trying to answer this particular question, and then also be able to monitor and evaluate the outcomes of those interventions that are actually going to be done, you know, by Swanis together with us using the evidence that we have. We hope this approach is actually going to generate sustainable jobs and also prepare the young generation, you know, who can have the benefit, who will have the benefit of any child development. Very briefly, I just want to touch on the question of HIV and AIDS. We know that you do need a healthy workforce in order to have a good economic development. The high rate of HIV in your countries do affect seriously the productivity of the workforce. And it also contributes to premature mortality. It also contributes to short life expectancy, particularly that we study in, you know, that affects the young and the community. The HSRC conducts quite a lot of work on HIV/AIDS. Many of you know about this particular study that we do regularly, of course, the South African National HIV Prevalence Incident Behavior and Communication Study. And we have looked at the whole question this year of are we making progress or not in terms of dealing with this particular epidemic. And we're pleased to say that there seems to be some signs that we're beginning to make progress, particularly when it comes to, you know, the young teenagers. If you look at this data very closely, you just see the new infections, you know, among the 15, 16, 17, 18, and 19 year olds are decreasing substantially. We can see the decrease of the 15-year-olds from 1 to 0.6 in terms of incidence, and from 1.6 to 0.5 and all that. And that is very encouraging that young people are beginning to do that. Now, some people may argue to say that, well, you know, maybe that is not so true. How do you know that? Well, anyway, we do have some data that actually show that the decrease in HIV incidence in a sexually active population is usually a result of a change in risky sexual behavior. And condom use, consistent and correct condom use, is one of the most effective means of actually preventing infection. And as you can see from this graph, the rate of condom use among young people has gone very, very high, particularly young men, just looking at from 57 to 87.4 over a period from 2002 to 2008. So there's a big improvement that we're actually seeing. And of course, the same thing we're seeing with young women. Of course, they're not being controlled of condom use, but they also are able to can say that they actually are using condoms at much higher rate than they did around 2002 or 2005. What's interesting is that even the older population, particularly those 50 years and older, we are beginning to see an increase in condom use, and that's where we need to be concentrating on, particularly that there's quite a lot of intergenerational sex, you know, between the young people and the older people. One of the groups that is very much neglected, you know, in terms of HIV prevention, are children in terms of HIV. And the HSS, as you can see, has been doing quite a lot of work. And here we just show you a picture of our young, well, not very young, but our researcher at the HSS, Dr. Linda Rasha, who has been a very, very good presentation in front of 25,000 people, you know, in Mexico. And that meeting was the, you know, International Wellbeing Conference. And also to say the World Health Organization also uses a lot of work that comes out from the HSRC. Our work is really done locally, but it has a global impact. And here we go, we have the latest report of the World Health Organization UNICEF on what universal access is actually uses information coming in from South Africa, showing that there's been a big increase in the proportion of people that actually know their HIV status or who have been tested, you know, in previous years. I mean, we're overall about 50% of the young people actually knowing, you know, their HIV status. The other one is just to indicate that we do a global impact on the same report of the towards universal access to healthcare. The HSRC is featured very, very widely on the work that was done by the HSRC on the multi-country study on the efficacy of HIV prevention strategies. And here it's really we're looking at the question of outcomes of incidence and stigma. One other area that is also neglected in South Africa is the question of the health of the older South Africans. We always concentrate on only the young people, but we do very little in so far the older people. And here we are, we started a major population-based study that is really looking at the health of older South Africans. And here we realized that in looking at it, we did not have as much biomarkers, you know, as we did. We now have information. We collected blood samples and they appear to be addressed, but we also looked at the basic things like the height and weight and body mass index. As a result of that particular study, we recommended that health promotion be introduced to improve the health status of South Africans because of the problems we found, like obesity, as well as the associated, you know, risk factors. Another area that the HSRC has been involved in is the question of the National Health Insurance System, where we play as a part of a team of professionals who backstop the efforts to develop a national health insurance as a means of reducing disparities in access to quality health care. Our role was to ensure that there is evidence-based research that was conducted on the health status of the population, on the human resources, on the models of health insurance in other countries. We have prepared the report and contributed to the report that has now been presented to the Minister of Health. And as we know, the Minister of Health has now appointed the Ministerial Advisory Committee that is going to be taking that way forward in order to be able to inform our country. Next area I just want to touch on is poverty and development. Here I must say that we do have the disparities that we have seen before are not just in the area of health, but you know, they are all over. We've got massive disparities in this country. we are actually a country that is very, very unequal compared to other places. That was actually, surpassed Brazil in terms of inequality. And part of that inequality really is because there are challenges that we are still experiencing, despite the fact that this country has improved in terms of access to water, in terms of access to electricity, to housing, and social assistance. However, we feel that the race and class issues are still needed to be addressed, particularly if you look at it by geographic location. Now, the HSRC has now turned its work around to focus a whole lot more and provide scientific evidence, scientific data for intervention. And we need to conduct research and services, in access to services, in terms of, services, employment, and also come up with some strategies that we can be able to do this. One of the projects that the HSRC did was the request by the Minister of Social Development of North Korea at the time in October 2008, and showed that the HSRC has had an impact in terms of contributing to the new Social Assistance Amendment Act of 2008. Which allows men aged 63-64 to receive social grants. That information has been very, very useful in terms of informing that particular amendment of the legislation. Another area that is especially discussed on very quickly is the question of service delivery. Service delivery, as we all know, is really a huge challenge in the country. There is no need to dwell on the statistics on service delivery. I think we know the protests that are happening all around the country. The HSRC is working together with local governments and is contributing to finding effective means of delivering services. Here I just referred to one project on the issue of funding disparity, which comprises three components, that is analyzing the institutional blockages to service delivery, so what can be done. Better mainstreaming and inspiring funded public works programs, and then of course for finding exercise and monitoring for expansion development work. So using this kind of evidence to generate solutions to problems, to planning, and to approaches to planning and implementation, this particular project is to enhance local interventions and innovations through a different approach. Now, the recommendations coming out of the studies are deemed to improve the quality and rate of service delivery in Kwale. And some of the things that we hope to achieve have already listed, on that slide. Now, coming back to what we are all about at the HSRC, we are about becoming a knowledge hub. And we are about doing quite a bit of work that extends beyond South Africa, but it goes all the way to the continent. We do want to work with a number of partners in the continent, and we've done quite a lot of work with the African Union, NEPA, Council for Development and Social Science Research in Africa, that is Provincia, affiliated members of social accountability. We've done some of the Sahara, we've done some of the Joint Learning Initiative of HIV Asian children. Now, that's where it has had a big impact, on the continent in a number of ways. With respect to the African Union, they commissioned the HSRC to draft a social policy framework. And once that policy framework was developed, it was then presented to the AU Conference of Ministers, and then who adopted that particular policy as a then group declaration of social development. As part of the Venture Declaration on Social Development. Now, that particular framework was aimed to assist the AU members in order to address the compelling and pervasive socio-economic challenges that are facing the continent. And then that social policy framework instead received endorsement from the AU Executive Council of Ministers and the Assembly of Heads of State and Government in Addis Ababa in January. This is just a very good example of how the HSRC actually has an impact on the mother continent. In terms of research and development, just want to say, we have received funding, regular research funding from the Department of Science and Technology, and we've conducted research on research, and we've conducted work on research and development, particularly a study that provided data for DFC to report on a national R&D survey, in terms of the training. And that set of data is very, very useful because it does feed very clearly into the development indicators for government, and it also gives us a trend analysis to say, you know, how much are we actually spending in South Africa with respect to research and development. And I was led that we are going to 14 billion versus 49% of the GDP by 2005 and 2006. Later reports will be able to give, you know, updated figures, you know, on this. And then, of course, we're doing an innovation survey that was given by DSG and has put in the consent. The other area I just want to touch on briefly is the question on knowledge and transformation. And just want to say, we at the HSR team believe that the knowledge not shared actually is very. It's for that reason that we continue to hold seminars, we organize symposia and conferences, and we often do it with domestic as well as international partners. One such event that we did is really the global symposium, which was organized with key international partners that you can see on the screen, the International Social Science Council, the International Council of Philosophy and Humanities Studies, and also did it with our, you know, local partners. And what we actually focused on was specific issues such as the production of knowledge by Africans and knowledge on Africa. We also looked at the contribution of human and social science to innovation and development. Now, we brought together more than 200, you know, top global social scientists and African scholars, and who participated in preparation of preparation of the papers. I just want to come into the last of the slide, which is really looking at the performance of the HSR team. While in the given time, it was not really possible for me to share with you all the critical work of the HSR team, which is in the report, I do hope that the research that I've presented to you is a given kind of work, a taste of what it is that we do at the HSR team, and I'm sure we can answer some of these questions. Now, I'd like to go through very briefly how it was actually performed over the previous year. If you look at that slide, all that green that you see, it means we're either achieved or exceeded, you know, the target for all of you. Whether it's in terms of our doing the work that is of public purpose that benefits the public, you know, 97% of the work that we do benefits the public. Our target was 90% and we were short. And working with the partners, you know, through implementation network, meaning that they participate in the work that we do up to the time that we actually provide them with answers, and up to the time that they use the information, our target was 60% and we hit 81%. In terms of the question of ensuring that we have attrition, we keep our staff, our attrition was very, very low. We managed to keep, you know, about 90% of our staff. You know, we only lost 90% of our permanent staff at the HSRC. And generous, which means that the managers at the HSRC, they are actually doing their level best to create an environment where scientists can be able to thrive as scientists. And the generous between training, which is doing that is about 82%, our target of 20% of the managers get our staff to be trained, being gender sensitive in terms of what it is that they are doing. Where we excel also is in the area of publication. We set up a target of 1.3 journal articles to be published in internationally accredited journals by the senior staff, but believe it or not, we're at 1.5, which is much higher than what you get in universities and other, you know, comparable type of institutions. And then in the junior researchers, in terms of, you know, growing our timber, we did exceptionally well because we had a target of 0.6 and the editor was 0.81. And then capacity building was bringing in more young people to enter into the HSRC and enter into the career, you know, of the HSRC, I mean, career of research. We actually did a non-stop better. We can see that we had 41 masters in 10, 36 PhDs in 10, and 12, you know, postdoctoral, you know, fellowship. In terms of finance, we did exceptionally well there also because we set our target to say that we should be able to get only 60% more than what, you know, in other words, the total amount of what we receive in terms of funding 60% of that should be external, given the fact that government has given us good respect. But instead, we ended up, you know, overshooting our target to 64%. And then finally, in terms of the multi-year grant, to ensure sustainability of the organization, we really far exceeded the target. Our target was 40% and we're at 60%. The only thing that we did not succeed on is really on getting enough money to do research with applicants in other parts of the continent. And that's where we fell short of our target. You know, we had expected that would be at 80% for Africa whole country, and we're only at 25%. For African research, they were expected to be 80%. And then the whole issue of transformation in terms of equity and representativeness, while the 80% now is predominantly black compared to what it was before, we're still having a challenge of getting African senior researchers. We set a target of 45% and we only managed to get 85%. So in summary, Jefferson, I just want to say that the research that we are doing at the HSRC does allow for social exploration leading to the application of social science, knowledge, while we are generating new knowledge. And the HSRC has performed very well, achieving 11 out of 14 important targets that we set up. And it's a growing concern in the sense that we are able to raise money to address the developmental challenges that we have in the country. And we do have an increase in the domestic, regional, as well as global reach. Thank you, Chair.
I'm wanting to focus on, as a couple of things, on the health aspect of it, and particularly in your annual report on page 136, where you talk of a national health initiative, and you also talk about the national health insurance. Now, I'm wanting to know who commissioned the research into the national health insurance. How much was spent on this? Was it peer reviewed, or was it basically done strictly on a commission basis? Were there outsiders involved? What input requested from the Treasury onto the financing of the insurance scheme? And can we kind of refer to the CDC's report? But there's one thing that bothered me particularly about this was the census that says funds were obtained to support the development of a national health insurance policy. To me, this implies that a decision had already been made, and you aren't meant to supply supporting information to what is essentially a political party initiative. I want to know what you mean by in support of.
And that's why the other division in how 1998
And when I say that that transition is entering a poetry movement, and what kind? I'm interested, I'm very interested when I've come to one or more than three people who have said we have been robbed by foreign missionaries on gunpoint. Now my question is, as have you managed to gain any whole kind of crime which is then being that the local crime, but in that local crime, in this crime, which we have committed, it is the local people or the foreigners, some of them. And I'm waiting to see what the IPM legitimately pretend in our area. When people say that we were robbed at gunpoint, and you said, I am a foreigner, I'm not a king, I'm just going to be a king, draw all the money. And a couple of people have been complaining because I'm saying it as an American. But the second thing on skills, maybe I'm sure that. In terms of the development of labor, have you managed to make a research on the impact of the recognition of violence on stigma? On the stigma in terms of HIV AIDS. We again at some point when we were in treatment in the house mentioned it again did conversation. HIV must be identified as a disease. Well, we are often understanding that if they then come to the side, it is also the issue of stigma preventing to address. One wants to check if then we have any contagion, that is then possible. I think the last question you are going to answer for the job in the draft of the red one, I think you have responded on that. One of the two concerns that we really wanted to achieve the same thing in terms of the African and what would be the reason for not that, or if people left with not the interest, or what is it? So, those are the two questions that I really wanted to put.
Thank you, Chair. Just to follow on from my colleague's questions around the NHI, I would like to know how can a proposal or recommendation based on research become legislation with specific reasons to the NHI? With regard to irregular inclusive expenditure, although the finances of the HSRC is something to be proud of, there are two incidences or two reports in the annual report. One is interest paid to the Department of Labor and Telecom for late payments. I mean, surely the accountant knows that the accountant has to be paid. Why would you be delay in payment? And surely your HR section knows that employees have to go through proper processes to be dismissed, and yet such a situation persists. And my last question, and put that into the CEO, is there any truth to the fact, or it is not saying the fact, is there any truth to the allegation that a communication has gone out from you to employees stating that there will be no payments or no salaries in the same time?
Yes, of course the report was quite intended. Stand the procedure one comment on the AG comment. And so in addition to the two that stand also the related expenditure. My reading of it is not serious because it was by a train of change that it was like water, but it was much more comment on it. And then check to run two things very briefly. Unfortunately, the first number is just by the title, the first one, the that's what the financial position data is of. You talk about the parliamentary grant contributing to your position on the state. What percentage of your income is the parliamentary grant? I should know, of course, so that's my brother, I find it, but it's better than I'm confused. And then the income from international sources, is it all from commission research, or do you also have donors? Then you mentioned that, of course, the graph shows the income and surplus of the deficit in the last 8 years. You mentioned there, of course, that it's quite a tough that you don't have services that you spend in the respect, I agree with that. My question is, how do you handle rollovers? Because you get a lot of multi-year funding, and what question is it up to unspent money and so on, and how do you manage that process? One question is dealing with the content of some of the fields of study that was referred to, and I will ask a couple of questions, but it was a bit updated, but I think you're giving a flavour of the kind of things that you do, just to inform us. But nonetheless, as a general question, how much of the research you do is commissioned by somebody as opposed to your initiating yourself? And if you initiate yourself, what is the basis upon which you choose that particular field or area versus another? I mean, I've given an example of a very good one you mentioned, it's crime, and I'm pretty happy with the fact that you study, which is no problem. But that means, that, for example, things like why South Africa is such a violent society. Is that an area that's done already, and it learns why we are so violent? Or is an area of government in my country that needs to explain why it's so violent? Or is somebody in your staff working on that area? I don't know. But I'm interested to know what informs your decision to watch your study. On labour. Have you done anything on the efficacy of teachers? I know there has been such criticism of their performance over the years, and I don't know if there's been any improvement. I'm interested in the graph you showed of the HIV incidence among 53-year-olds dropping, and then the following graph showing increased economy. It's quite striking, there's about a 50% drop in the incidence of HIV/AIDS, and yet about a 10% increase. So that would suggest there's a lot more at stake, and I presume behavioural change, but I don't know, maybe you could speak to that. But if it's true, well, perhaps something rather incredible, isn't it? You mentioned partly, again, it's an area that has the same question I've asked about from the study, but the whole issue of Gini coefficient of the country being the highest in the world now. It's something that concerns all of us, and one thing I'm particularly keen to know is why that's the case. I mentioned certain factors, but the question would be to me, of 15 years of a government whose virtually sole mandate is to address inequities in the past, and constitutions which are addressed in terms of first economic rights, how about 15 years of endeavour be the worst in the world? I mean, it just kind of doesn't make sense. You work for one of those countries that report data from which you can compare this. I mean, it makes no sense whatsoever to me. So I'm very keen, and I think others will be keen on why. Presumably, the question why this would be a failure never. On service delivery, do you have any relationship with the department, the COPTA, and your cell in the secondary commissioning research? And then, innovation survey commissioned by DSC. I'd love to have the students' department to use that now. They can make it available to us. We are somewhat interested in the field. I had no idea that this had been done, and I'm very happy to be done. I'd love to read it. The department has to get a copy, and the committee members would be very happy. And then, lastly, on performance, particularly understated your performance, actually. Because you've been done with a team 11 out of 14. My resume says you've done 14 out of 17. There are 17 indicators here, not 14, and you've achieved 14 of them. So I think that's better than you said. But I must say that obviously you set a target, because a target means before we get the target, the credibility is coming from the target being a valid target to start with. Now, I'm not saying that that's not a valid target, but my question is who set the target, and on what basis do you set the target to be this? Because obviously if it's set too low, you look like that it fails. So is it yourself that says it, the board says it, or how do you determine it? Thank you.
cannabis, that also enters into consideration. You said there was a set of reference that you are doing in collaboration with the Southern public. My question is, it not possible to expand this piloting project, not only doing it with the farming, because you may find that the environment in farming is different from other areas. Maybe just take a place like Swane and Botswana and find a large area and take another area for an area and a large area. Then, and the third area where you will do the piloting exercise. And that will assist you to get at least a balanced information and using the balance for the direct environment and getting the facilitating with the employment creation, etc. Maybe I know you say it's because of budget and things like that, but I think for me it will be more profile and give more effective information if we are looking in a different area. Secondly, in terms of that, we've seen a number of places related protests of service delivery protests related. In terms of your studies, are these protests really actually related to service delivery or something else, but they end up taking the form of service delivery? I'm asking that because I've seen in Mpumalanga they end up naming the very same community hall, the very same structures or libraries and things like that, as part of service delivery. And on the other hand, they're continuing about service delivery, but at the same time, they're banning this thing that are at least better than. So, and the real issue in Mpumalanga was about the 10 million that was disappeared. It was not really about service delivery, but it was the money that was disappeared in the municipality and things like that. In terms of, let's leave politicians, because politicians will say whatever they want to say, but in terms of your study, can you ask us to understand this process better? Thanks.
Can you take my question?
Sure.
So that we find a light. I think the honorable member has started one of my questions. Which is important. Really, I also wanted to know if you have done any research into digital delivery projects and what are findings, which can actually be part of the school experiment in our oversight. The other question also I wanted to ask is very much related. It is problem that has been imposed by the new proposed legislation to allow police to defend themselves when confronted with the violence of the police. And the growing element of protest from the corner that it doesn't be happy that they're being protected by police, saying that actually it is wrong, criminal. The police are not, cannot be given the power. How far, who is talking the joke between those concerns and the concerns of the Minister of Police? What do they see? But that's very much scary. There has been a concern that was expressed directly to me by one of the researchers in one of the institutions. I will not say which one, but it's very related to an institution probably. These research institutions in South Africa, they are flat.
significant number of foreign researchers who, when they are given the task of going to research some specific topic, they get a lot of money to that. And usually what they do, they go to their home country, in particular the African researchers. They go to their country, and then they simply go and use the money, and they go to professors there to give them some research, or related to that, without having done any research, and they'll come back with papers or going to the research. Actually, they have said to me the same thing. All foreign researchers that are employed by our focus capital. They usually, if it says where they did their research in a particular university, they did it in their own country. Even when their country did not have the capacity to produce useful results on that particular aspect. That customer thing is then you wonder why the government is simply leaving this thing unconfronted or undetected. Because there's a lot of money that is given to these researchers who simply go and invest in their countries, and this money can come back. I want to address us how much tourism is, and if so, what is being done. Then we are actually at the juncture of the 2010 FIFA game. And I'm sure that so we need a lot of assistance from ourselves to guide what exactly is going to happen in terms of traffic, in terms of crime, in terms of everything. How much has been progressing this assisting the government in terms of analyzing the pros and cons of the forthcoming FIFA case in South Africa. Your slide, one of your slides, talks about something which is very much of my passion, which is education and science. Because it just needs another point, and professors. Education, science, and fair. How much research has been done in this aspect? I know that currently the Department of Education, but indeed also the head of of education and health. They are looking into developing a prototype program for transforming education in South Africa. I was even asked myself to make a proposal if I have and develop some proposal. Because they know that I've always been passionate about education and science. So, as you've been engaged in this particular area. But over and above, there is an institute that I was particularly to its development in Germany, the most student institute. They've got at the end of this year, they are inviting data. They are trying to develop exactly the interaction between science and society and the philosophy of Ubuntu. What it means, how much can be developed, how much can be rooted into society. If you have any, probably, briefing about this forthcoming conference, and if so, what preparations do you have? Because I would like some of you to present it, but I think it's very important. I was even speaking
speaking to the Minister of Education, and he was saying that he was very much interested in Ohio education. Finally, we'd like to meet him to Ohio, Minister of Ohio education. Now, whenever you bring a structure, I mean an annual report, part of what it should reflect or comment is the successes that you've had since you presented your structure under the proof of the year, and of course the challenges and the difficulties that you've confronted and how you think they can be solved. And why, if they can't resolve the things that the committee should assist, or indeed any potential stakeholder in overcoming the problem, I do not have anything about it. But what I also not have here is anything related to climate change. I was absorbed to tell you that anything about climate change in the midst of only 1 month, not even 1 month, less than a month, I mean, before population. And this morning I was accompanied by two stations wanting to know what exactly we are doing on climate change. What are the outputs here to continue the FAR? There are many committees involved there. They were asking why all of a sudden so many committees that we interest in climate change, or the thought that this should come from a report that we are confronted at the juncture of this year, with a very important threat, which is a conference on the climate with his threat. And so I do not have anything about this. Of course, I should also finally congratulate all the entities of the department from the report. If you don't know, the AG, Auditor General, finally, the Department of Science and Technology that has got this record. So that should also go to the entities, all the entities of the department and the department are doing very well. Of course, it's been like that for some many years, but except this year, we alone have got this new record. Therefore, I think it will be there. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chairperson. I want to take a question. Anything to do with finance, I would have our finance person also voted often. Or anything on education and skills, Dr. Ray. Anything on crime, Dr. Juan Nicolio. Anything on service delivery and FIFA, Minister Dr. Eventi Wayne. Anything on performance of the HSLC, Dr. Christopher Trey. And anything on health and HIV and overall our affairs. Okay. So we'll divide it in that way. Let me start with the next one on the shoulder. Just want to say to the Honourable Member that in 2006, the HSRC published a very interesting study of the general population of South Africa to find out what their views were on measures of insurance. And we're surprised to find that, you know, there was quite a lot of interest in the population on NHI. And there was a large number of people that did not know enough to talk about 30% of the population that living. And following that, the HSRC then had a colloquium in 2007 and invited all people from the private sector, public sector, you know, parliament, the research societies and all that. And the report is available, you can get it on the internet. And at that particular meeting, there were two plenary presentations that were given. One was given by the Minister of Health,
the former minister of health, on their view, on national health insurance, on what data they consider to be important and what is to be done. The second one I made a presentation based on the work that has been done in South Africa on national health insurance from 1995. So it's not something new whatsoever. It's something that has been going on for quite some time. So subsequent to this colloquium, we participated in a committee for national health insurance, which included treasury, it included social development, you know, people from social development, it included people from the HSRC, people from the health department, it included a whole range of people from the private sector, you know, groups from the medical field, from you know, the drug area and so forth. And collectively developed from a scientific data, using the information that is available, we collected information and prepare a draft policy. And that draft policy indeed did go to the AAC, but also went to the Minister of Health. And the reason for it going into the Minister of Health is that we cannot develop such an important policy without involving the scientific community. The scientific community has got the responsibility to take the ideas that are funded by the ministry and turn them into something that is scientifically of value. And that's what we did. And we talked to many international people and put together that policy document. Unfortunately, I cannot share with you that outcome of that because of the fact that it's not a work which is intellectual property, just issues of it. As I indicated, there were so many other departments that they participated in that. And, so many other stakeholders, community stakeholders that participated. And therefore, I would say if we're patient enough, we will get the Minister of Health releasing it after Cabinet has taken a decision on it. And in that particular point, it will become a document that can actually be the basis for consultation with all of the key stakeholders. Where we actually commission, we're never commissioned to do this thing. There's no commission. Did we go out and get money to be able to do our portion of the research? Yes, we did. We went out and got the money and we did what we needed to do in terms of our scientific work. We were not, we're focusing on our science and on what it is that we're best able to do. Your other question was, yes, no, I think I've answered that one. Let me come now to the next one. The next question is on health, has to do with, sorry, that's so many questions. I mean, I'm way through 57 questions here. The next question on health that you asked, because HIV incidence is dropping. Honorable member, the evidence that we have in front of us is that the condom use cannot just be the only explanation. We simply picked up a few things simply because it's not possible to give you a whole presentation. But the prevention of mother-to-child transmission in the country has contributed to the reduction in new infections, you know, among children, and it has also contributed to, you know, reduction also in the particularly the not only the death of those children, but also the cancelling itself, particularly getting it has done reduce the number of infections because these women, when they go in, they get cancelled before that, you know, they really should not be getting involved in risky sexual behavior. So there is a degree of change, you know, that's happening within South Africa. And in addition to that, the multiple partnerships among young women are not as high in the province. It continues to be high among young men, but young men use condoms. So they have, they run around, but they make sure that they are protected. And they are protecting themselves from becoming sexually infected. I'm inclined to believe that the HIV incidence that we are seeing is something that is real, especially if you look at the federal analysis that we did using some of the other approaches that are used internationally. We're beginning to see a decline seriously in terms of community infection. And any epidemic up to a certain point will also, you know, reach a certain point where actually the number of people that are susceptible, you know, decrease over time. So that is also another, you know, question. And then the other issue that you raised about the Gini coefficient, what are the reasons for the high Gini coefficient? I'm sure the reasons are multiple, and I'm sure my colleagues will add to it. But let me take one in the health area. If you think about it, 21 billion rand is spent by people out of pocket for health care. 21 billion rand a year. That's a lot of money. It means that those of us with resources are taking away the doctors, the nurses, the facilities, the resources for ourselves. And we're leaving other people without it. They don't have it in the public sector. We have it in the private sector. We make sure we get what we want, any time that we want, as many things as we want to have. Now, when you do that, it means that those people who are poor have no choice but to take the little bit of savings they have to be able to pay for that GP out there. These are things that are causing inequalities in our society. Is this unevenness in access to resources? With jobs, the same thing. The best job, some of us take our best job and we give only to the people that look like us, only. We are not ensuring that the entire population is with an equal chance of actually getting a new job. So, few people control the economy, the rest of the other people have to take whatever crumbs that are there. These are the things that are causing inequality in the country. And then when people try to resolve this problem, there's a major concern out there to say, why are you changing this? Why are you wanting this, you know, access to services for everybody? Whether it is welfare we're talking about, whether it's health insurance we're talking about, whether it's education we're talking about, there is this fundamental problem that we don't have a basis in the society of equality. We've got a basis of I have to get more for myself, even if nobody else has anything. So whenever you try to cut them, that's what's happening. From a philosophical point, that's what's happening. But from a practical point, we can see the figures themselves of employment, who's getting paid. If you look at the salaries that are being paid, they are very, very high among a few percentage of the population. The bulk of the population is on what? Some people might say that it's 2,500 a month. Yes. Part of the population is on 2,500. How many of us here can actually live on 2,500 a month? Very, very few. We couldn't. So it's something that we really need to look at ourselves to start advocating. So what do you want to do in order to improve? And if I'm wrong, I'm sure Dr. Kinney was correct and I'm trying to talk about this issue that might have to touch on that perspective. And then the next issue that I would like to address, Center for Excellence with funding, can you expand it to other areas? I think once they, the idea is that once they learn how this thing works, we get a lesson learned from this exercise, we surely will be willing to expand it to other areas. I've already raised this to the program that they're telling me English to say, let's learn as quickly as we can what works, and then, you know, recommend that it actually be spread, you know, around the country so that everybody can be able to benefit. The other issue I wanted to address is the challenges that we have. You're quite right that we did not indicate the challenges that we have. The first biggest challenge we have is this red race of raising funds all the time. Our staff are spending a lot of time raising funds to be able to do the work that is of national importance. We would prefer, if we could, to come up with a different balance
of parliamentary grants to external grants. We would like it ideally to be where we have 60% of our funding from government and then we can raise the other 40%. It's important that we change this so that we can be able to retain our senior level staff in the organization in the long run. Because when the contract ends after 5 years, you know, by the fourth year they are beginning to look somewhere else to say, well, do I have enough money to be in? If they don't have any grants, then they've got to think about looking for a job somewhere else. So we'd appreciate if we can get some help on that. And especially that the association committee is able to actually fix the budget, and we hope that we become our advocate to the association committee to actually ask that we be given an increase in our budget of 60%.
Particularly
that
the demonstration that we can
actually deliver.
No, there has been actually concern about the state owned institution, not knowing how or whether they should continue with their public mandate, or they should commercialize themselves in perpetual health, you know, finances for survival. It's still a network in the community based trade.
Okay, thanks so much. And then the other challenge that we have is the SPM, the supply chain management. And the PSMA is set up for government entities, where there is a policy of where money comes from, when that money is going to come, and the rules and regulations obviously are set up on how that money should be spent. As a statutory council, we constantly have a big problem. We are not certain at the beginning of the year how much money we're going to get, from who, and what regulations come with that particular money. Money coming in from overseas often have their own rules and regulations that we're supposed to follow. We sometimes do not necessarily agree with the rules in government. And we struggle. As in fact, I can say now that we've implemented SPM and we're following this literally, we're beginning to see a slowdown in the delivery of our work. We're not able to finish the report that we want because we've got to wait for SPM, and sometimes, you know, the only person who can do that work is a scientist in that particular area is located maybe in Cape Town, and you want to use that person. But you're going to follow the set of procedures to be able to do that, and it doesn't make any sense. So what we suggest is that Secretary, maybe we should bring ourselves together with our Accountant General to sit down and really get the issue with regard to Secretary Council. Not just the issues of the but the overall rule of the Secretary Council to say, can they come up with different procedures for accountability other than the PFNA for Secretary Council? We're not saying we're running away from accountability. We always want to make that accountability, but we want accountability that enables, not accountability that becomes a barrier to actually deliver. On the question of climate change, maybe I'll think he may say something about, you know, what it is that we're actually doing on that. And then there was another question that I should be answering. It's who determines what the state is doing. The HSRC scientists are allowed to become innovative. Scientists thrive in a very innovative environment. So they have a combination of self-initiated research, and a lot of researchers are really initiated, but actually self-initiated. They look at the priorities of this country and they say, what are the challenges that this country is actually facing? What research can we actually carry out? And then even when the tenders are advertised in government, they look at them and say, which one really do we think that we should actually go for? You know, in terms of what is required, should somebody else be doing this rather than us? You know, especially if there are small projects that are just, you know, running the middle type of projects, sometimes just letting investors be the ones that are doing it. And then we take the big ones that really address significant challenges that the country is facing, and then, you know, we actually go, you know, for those. What informs us, maybe priorities of the country, maybe the state of research, you know, that the knowledge that exists in currency, that we feel that there is very little knowledge that exists in this particular area. So that would apply to any of the projects that we're actually working on right now. Let me stop there and have Dr. Kiley come up with a second on the question of the decision. On the question of stigma, we have been conducting quite a number of studies. One was in a 6-5-year study that we've been which we involved the University of Western Cape and the University of Limpopo, and we did it with 10 state universities to try to understand stigma as defined internally by the person and stigma as defined externally. And we actually found that there's quite a lot of self-stigma that is contributing to the problem, where a person realizes that they are HIV positive and thinks everybody around must know that they are HIV positive. And then they start censoring themselves in terms of where they can go, where they cannot go, particularly when they start losing weight or they start having some signs that tell them that, you know, maybe I'm sick, and other people realize that I'm actually sick. So what we're suggesting is really to work with those people who are HIV positive on how to, you know, not consider themselves to be outcast, but to consider themselves to become, that they are members of society, that HIV is like any other disease that people have. And as long as they take an education where the CD4 count gets down, they will be able to live a normal life. And also help them to disclose their HIV status, but disclose it in a manner that they don't, it doesn't result in violence, you know, against them. So that is something that, you know, from the research that we've done, we've been recommending, you know, to people that are living with HIV. And I must say that it's something that, you know, it's getting better in South Africa, especially external stigma, it's getting better in South Africa. Our data is beginning to show that, you know, people say, I can marry somebody who is HIV positive. That's something we didn't hear years ago, you know, from the research side. So people are beginning to say, you can't actually leave with this disease. It's not the end of the world.
I'll be brief, because I know you want to go back to your public hearing. Just a reflection on the question about income inequality and the Gini coefficient, which I think is around 26% now. There has been a recognition, I think, that some of our employment creation, poverty mitigation, and these strategies have failed, or have not made sufficient inroads over the last 15 years. So there's a robust debate developing in relation to employment creation about labour market regulation, the commodity-based economy, etc. Likewise, there's a debate around definitions of poverty, measurements and interventions, and with regard to the discussion debate about beneficiaries and who the target population should be. But there is a recognition that policies could be aligned slightly better. On the issue of whether we're working with Salga and Dr. Peter on the turnaround strategy. The interesting thing is I was approached directly by Dr. about 3 months ago, rather than the HSRC going to Dr. and telling them we'd like to be involved with the turnaround strategy. Most recently I've been asked to comment, like my colleague Kwandi, on the turnaround strategy, which was only released on the 12th of November. And I had a discussion with the presidency yesterday, in fact, on developing a set of indicators that helps us to better measure performance across a range of benchmarks or criteria, which are slightly different from the conventional ones used over the last 15 years. The issues in terms of the REIT tend to be slightly more political and institutional now rather than technical or technocratic. With respect to South, I've worked with them on a citizen voice project, which is one of the big issues in service delivery. And we're speaking to them today, actually, on a local government restructuring group. So that engagement is quite dynamic. Minister Karim also recently commissioned me to do some work on the role of public utilities at the local government level. in providing services as opposed to services that are provided exclusively by the municipality themselves. So that's sort of ongoing. On the issue of Balfour, Sakile, the issue was about the 30 million rand that was irregularly spent by the municipality, and I think the Minister finds council and as well the relevant provision in the municipal system. But it is about how delivery stuff, housing, water and sanitation, but there's also a feeling on the ground that there's a disconnect between councillors and local communities. And you hear the issue of cable deployment, for example, becoming a big one now, in which councillors lack the requisite skill and capacity to deliver on the ground, largely as a result of the deployment process, which hasn't recognised the skills that may be required at the local level. And you have all sorts of allegations about crime, corruption, mismanagement, misinformation. So I think you're right. It's as much about the political and institutional as it is about the harm. Backlog, extension strategies, and so on. Can we understand the process better? I think slightly more, we need to do more diagnostic work on the reasons, capacity, skills, intergovernmental relations, public participation, accountability, unfunded mandates. But I also think we need to be thinking slightly more about creative intervention strategies at the local level. It's fine to talk about a long-term turnaround strategy, as COPTA has recently, but in particular, for example, it always strikes me that COPTA could have said, for example, that here's a short-term 3 to 6 month strategy, given your housing or your water constraints, as a gear up to our longer strategy, which we try to meet some of those bold and ambitious targets. On FIFA, we've done a lot of work. Page 56 of the annual report cites some of that. We started a project 5 years ago at the HSR for measuring the urban impact or the urban legacy of the 2010 FIFA World Cup. Our clip emanated a number of Slovakian longitudinal study on attitudes on crime, traffic and so on and so forth. And all that culminated in the launch of a book about 3 months ago on the urban legacy of the 2010 World Cup, which I edited, and talked directly in the economic, social, cultural benefits on the attitudinal study has actually mapped longitudinally the impact on South Africa on crime, poverty, transport, and so on and so forth. Page 56 has a picture of the book and a little insert on what the project is about. On climate change, its nascent development at the HSRC. Over the last 5 years, I think research on climate change has focused more on the hard stuff, emissions, trading, CO2 stock, impact on the economy and so on and so forth. There's been little work on the social impact, on social adaptation strategies, and the HSRC has begun to develop that. I can't remember who we pitched a proposal on social impact to, but we've written
one night
scan. space, right? So that particular report we had in my copy and quite detailed as the way how this particular category of crime by foreign nationals in South Africa is having a serious impact on these specific models. But on other categories of crime, maybe the evidence is anecdotal because the crime statistics are not helping as you said at the moment. But we are really trying to see what we can get out of field work material that we can then relate to trying to manage our crime statistics. Then the other question is about the so what the legal approach to kill. One of my colleagues, currently a bachelor of business, where they declare just an opinion on this particular matter. But the field really is quite broad, quite general, really an opinion. And what we decided is that really we could, it would be good for us to think on the basis of evidence, which has been analyzed on this particular issue. And what he promised and we are going to do is to try and examine case by case incidents around particular matter, so that we can then provide the public with a more evidence based and coherent analysis.
Thank you. I'm responding to three questions. The one about the speaker, the element of the event, and I think the member here has asked about that on the RPL, and then the question about science and society and the kinds of work that we do. In terms of the work around whether we had undertaken any studies to look at the CETA, with the Department of Labor, we didn't look at the CETA or the governance issues, but one of the questions that was raised above was what has been the impact of the learnership program. Now, given that the Department of Labor or government has set up the active labor market strategy of using learnership as a form of training, they asked us to undertake this research. And we undertook a massive study and both set up a different and unique methodology about getting the list from all the speakers of people that have undertaken them, being on the learnership. And it's not just about participating in the learnership, but tracking them over time to look at both their completion rate and then to look at their update into the labour market and how they have progressed and what has been the impact of their learnership. Now with regards to the learnership, and there's a massive report that we have, but also since we can advertise some HSRC products, we have the HSRC review, which I think goes on to all parliament, everyone in parliament. No? But you know, there are articles there to listen already, the key findings are so, and we have a couple of articles on the learnership. But the key point of the learnership, we found that there were high levels of training and participation in learnership. What we also found that the racial breakdown mirrors the kind of learnership that people participate in. The African and coloured participants in learnership undertook those that were at a lower level of skills and white people at a higher level of skills. The other thing is that we had what we call learnership from 18.1 level, that means we were working and related to learnership, and 18.2, which was unemployed people. And so a number of unemployed people also participate in the learnership. And what we're finding is that the career trajectory is actually zigzag rather than moving forward. And if somebody had a trick at entry level 4, they then went and participated in a learnership so that they could get qualifications that were more labour market related qualifications. And so on the entry level, they moved backwards, but this gave them an opportunity to participate in the labour market. So the answer to that question is that we haven't undertaken research in terms of the governance of the sector, which has been more in the public domain. We haven't looked at any research in terms of how the minister might be structured. And I think there's a whole lot of discussion and debate about that, but what we've looked at is the impact of the membership program itself. The other question on the recognition of prior learning. We didn't do this work for the Department of Labour, but we have done a takeoff for the Department of Education and how RPL works. And it's actually a bit of a contradiction in that RPL works better for higher level qualifications than for lower level qualifications. So if you're going for something in accreditation for a higher level qualification and the way the assessment criteria is set up, you can participate in and you can, you know, provide your full portfolio of your experiences for somebody to evaluate it, and you can use the RPL. But somehow it was originally designed for people that are, you know, at a lower level of qualifications who may not be able to write and put their whole portfolio together for assessment. So there is a contradiction in that it's more difficult for people at lower educational level where they need this to actually use the RPL. So we have a take on that. On the question of science and society, I think an invitation for this, but I'm continuing to have a particular activity.
No, Professor Modi. Professor Modi is the CEO of the
agriculture.
No, it's under economic development ministry.
Okay.
Economic development. Yeah. It's under Minister Mobia Code.
Okay. The whole question of science and society and is a critical one. And for us, the first challenge about this is that if we take it from the education and schooling point of view, we have a curriculum, and underlying the key objective for the curriculum is how are you going to give learners a set of skills and competencies so that they can participate in global knowledge economy. And again, a kind of contradiction, in order to access the curriculum, you need a certain set of experiences. And we've been doing work nationally, and you go to different areas of the country, and you go to Tanzania, you go to Mashlabatini. You look at the experiences of that child, that learner is there. And if you ask yourself the question, how is that child going to access a curriculum to participate in the global economy? And so the big challenge with schooling is then how do you scaffold the experiences that the child is at the moment? Because we do want to participate in the knowledge economy, and we've made those kinds of decisions. So the challenge is to kind of scaffold that. And then how do you use science and society and the particular basis of that child? And so we also, looking at that, but what I would say is that in our program, we highlight the look at some big issues and try to contextualize it. If you're looking at innovation, innovation generally leads to R&D and technological development. When we're looking at innovation in what we call low-income countries, and all the South Africa categorized as low-income countries, but the middle-income countries, and the pockets of the areas, the low-income countries. And so we focus the research agenda in terms of what the National Advisory Council Innovation Core is a broad-based innovation, but we don't like that term. It's non-R&D-based innovation. Innovation for livelihoods, for sustainability, looking at diseases, looking at how you can improve crops, etc. So in that case, and our research agenda on innovation that leads to society is very much in terms of areas of looking at what they are doing. Equally, we are looking at the issue of public relationship with science. And if looking at public relationship with science, we don't want to just look at understanding because we don't want to come up to the presupposition that institutional is. We're looking at it from the point of view of what kind of communication also occurs with the public in able to enhance their knowledge and skills, and what is that they bring. And And so within that framework, we're proposing that in terms of in assessing the public, not only by baseline, but also indigenous knowledge systems. Just one very second point is that I think the way in the ASRC, a number of large-scale surveys that are conducted over time, and these surveys give us a barometer of how the society and how the country is progressing. We have things like the African Social Attitude Survey, and there are a number of items and a number of things that were asked there. We have these kind of trend data. And similarly, with regards to master sites, we will be undertaking the achievement studies, participating in international trends and international math and science study next year, which unfortunately was very poorly 8 years ago, the poor performance. But again, at the Asian Council, we have the infrastructure to participate in these international and international studies, which will give us a sense of how we benchmark.
I think you know, many of the things that have just asked, indigenous knowledge systems, the child in a rural area or rural community in a social life, economy, so that's exactly what that institute is doing. Because the Institute of Technology, Philosophy and Political Science. It serves as a passion of the society. Actually, what you have said, those are the things that I think, actually, the edit. Dr. Ferry is the one who is the head of academia. She has dialed them, she does develop some papers on she does and training, whatever. She's the one in charge of the academy, the head of academy, and dealing with it. And she's the one, I think, who is conducting the conference of who is putting together all that. I think it will be very useful to work with developing. Well, that's the vision of how we're looking at the future of South African education, which must produce a complete child. We've got here as we care, right? Because most of the children in science and technology, they have their own as a doctor and pharmacist only. They have never seen anything else. So if you go to a rural area, you know, a child is what you want to do with mathematics, doesn't know what why he is or he is studying mathematics. And so kindergarten is a small level. It's also a very important thing. And that's part of it. You know, I think interacting with them will really give more input to what they want to do. Yeah. All right.
Thanks, Dr.
I think the issue was about the table on pages 162, 163, and target. And the first thing is that target 5, 7 and 8. And we set a target to say in terms of representativeness at senior research level, we would like to see the African senior researchers grow, which means a reduction in the other categories. So what happens is if we didn't meet the target for African representatives, then we would have exceeded the target for the other categories, but we actually wanted to have it lower than that. So what we said is if we count it 4 times, we will fail 4 times or we will achieve it 4 times. So rather count it once. That was the one. And you also asked about how do we set these targets. The targets are set on a 3-year basis. When we do our annual strategic planning, we say these are the targets set over a 3-year period. There is a debate, it is at 2 levels, and we get the research programs to set their own targets that they think they will be able, or they think they will be able to achieve. Then there's a negotiation to say we think we need to grow the target in this area, what resources will have to be made available in order to achieve that target. And then the collective target of the HSRC is built on the individual targets that the research program is on. We do adapt targets over time. For instance, we see the target for African Research Center. We have set an ambitious target of 12 for the previous year. We didn't achieve it. We set a target of 10 for the next year. We still didn't achieve it. We will not lower the target
indefinitely, but we want to have a target that is achievable, but yet make an effort to
the
and very sensitive. And there is also further question of our external income when it also comes in the national funding that is going to be also released the funding from the central
and it is also includes government departments and
a member question or answer? No, it's fine. I'm asking if the one that is because they have a 20% and that they all been covered.
Yes. Okay, all right.
Then any follow up questions?
Thank you. Dr. Shana, in your response to my question about the research into NHI, you said that you did go out and get funding to complete the scientific work on it. Can you tell us who you sought funding from and whether perhaps any of that was money from the Gates Foundation? Then other questions that I have on page 138 of the annual report regarding the conflict of the developmental state. You said a book on the conflict of the city which you published 2009-2010. You have a book that's out there. When is it published? And we expect to know on that. Also, I'd like to know if the cost, I presume it was for the MSRC account, of saving these colloquialisms on and on the NHI. And then we talk about proposals building on HSRC coordinated work around developmental states and submission of the development agency that was under Section 10 for African social progress. Can you please expand on this? What is the purpose of sharing this work with these other development agencies? Which are they? What is the progress in that?
Thank you. quite comprehensive because they had a whole suite of competing factors. You know, notwithstanding the lack of a proper infrastructure, lack of proper, lack of human and non-human resources. So to kind of give a response like that's one of the things that they say. The client or the person that spoke to me about this was not agreed that they had to come to the Democratic Alliance regarding the data. What I did find interesting, or your response indicated that without invoicing completion of the research that they are doing, they will not get paid. Exactly what I understand from your response. Now, I don't know, does that mean to say the person does not complete their work in December and they don't invoice it in December, they will not get a salary, or will they not get paid for the work or the research that they were contracted to do? I'm not understanding clearly what your memo is about. And in this following on that, on page 209, when one looks at the fees paid to council members and executive management, there's an increase of 3 million from 2008 to 2009. With the CEO herself making an increase of 300,000. So, who decides on these categories? I mean, does the board decide? Is it decided by statute, by the minister? Is it performance bonuses? I'd like to have an understanding of how the one gets a 3 million grand increase in salaries from 1 year to the next.
Just a couple of reasons. On the financial figures, my last question was how much of the international funding is donor funding as opposed to paying for research and being commissioned. I wasn't sure if I heard that one. Do you get donor funding as straight donation? And if so, how much? Puzzling question. Okay, alright. Well, this is not a new one. And then, this is silly thing. I mean, the telephone story you told us was accounting late. What you're going to want to say is the late payment. You know, it's interest on late payment. Now, you shouldn't be paying interest on late payment because the billing is made from telecom. So, it's kind of weird to call that. And then just a couple more to the new one. What's your relationship to the board? How do you interact with the board? And then, is there a performance management system in place? And if so, what sort of assessment is done, and where is it done, and what are the outcomes of those assessments? Thanks.
I sort of one clarification myself in terms of this salary issue. When you hire people or personnel in an organization, you specify that you are under a foreign donor fund, and so you will only get in the contract to tell that you won't be getting a salary, you will be only getting because to me that sounds like it, you must produce a new subject, some kind of obligation. You are compared to the consultant that it is only upon having finished a certain piece of work that you get money. Can I clarify between salary and consultancy contract? What type? How do people get contracted there?
I must say on that question, starting with that one, there's a difficult misunderstanding on the part of the individual, or even in the way in which the person has communicated the information. First of all, let me say that salary bearer of the agency of students is higher than what we get from Parliament for salary. We therefore augment our salary with funding that we get extended. We write that proposal and inform the donor in terms of what we are going to do in terms of salary, you know, payment. So the department will give us its money, and then at a certain point during the year, we now have to rely largely on foreign funding or for domestic funding. So what we do is we invoice on projects as the project gets completed, and that money is then put together to pay the entire staff that is supposed to be. So it's not about the individual, it's actually about the entire organization. Can we afford to pay a salary bill, which is somewhere 15 million a month? Right? So that being the case, it means that if a large proportion of programs do not submit their invoices and complete their work, it has an effect on the entire organization. And that's what the situation is. And in other words, it creates a cash flow problem. We have the money, it's sitting in a bank with interest. We can't use it unless we can prove to us that we've actually delivered on what we're supposed to do. So we then send out messages and reminding staff that it is that time again of the year where you have to deliver in terms of your invoices and make sure that the contract is completed.
No, just a good point. What then happens, suppose is that there is significant let me put it, a significant number of people are not completed their project, and then the 16 million, then you have a shortfall of which we would have recovered from the submitted invoices to make that 16 million. Say you have only for the submitted project, you only can recover 12 million support. Then what happens is, if you then average the 12 million so that everybody gets less or whatever, that's what you can
do. That's why I send an email to the manager and say, you are in a crisis, you are supposed to do this so that that doesn't happen. It hasn't happened so far that we pay to pay salaries, but we want it. We say, you really need to deliver. If you don't deliver, this is the thing. And we want them in advance. So, you know, we told them way earlier to say there is a vendor so that they have enough time to finish up their report. And it's not that on a quarterly basis we don't work with the executives. We do. But sometimes the workload is just too much and, you know, they delay and they delay all that. And then there were questions that were asked.
An example on that.
Yeah,
do you have standard targets, for example, by completion of a particular time, then you would access the money? Do you have something like that? And do you have challenges that you put out for each of these projects? I'm just trying to understand, and are we speaking on fixed salaries? And in addition to that, they're getting money for the research that they are doing?
No. It's one salary. The sources may differ, but it's one salary. It's one salary pay that we get. So, what is going on?
We, on the research side, this project, we make use of a model called
can you put the mic on that field? We sometimes can't hear very well.
What I was on a research project, each research is basically based on a certain percentage of time on the research project. And by those, it is specified in the system that they whether you are a research director, a chief research specialist, if that is or what it is, the thing might be. And there's different things linked to the different levels of researchers. So basically what happens, they will report the time on which they work on a specific project, which is called the time domain. And from that, that is the portion that we can recover from a specific project from a donor. Now what happens with the funding that we receive, every contract is a contract being signed with every
specific donor or party that's funding us, and in the terms of conditions, it also explicitly tells you that there is different five phases to this contract. The first delivery will take place on the when the literature review is completed, the second phase will be when the main survey has been completed, and the claim data. And based on the delivery of those phases within the contract and with the research being done, only then the drawdown can take place if the funding has been received in advance and is on our investment. In the case where we do not receive funding in advance, that is more applicable to local studies, especially those government departments, which is also governed by the CFMA and state regulations, where income is not supposed to be distributed in advance to the party. We will invoice to those parties to say that we have completed phase one. This is the copy of the first report regarding phase one and all the deliverables regarding that, and we will issue them with an invoice and they will make payment to us. I hope.
Yes, sorry. He's still trying to make a follow up again, still for clarification. We do need clarification.
Sure. Okay. I think there might be the senior might be more late hearing and it's maybe the mistake of a lot of time. I must say, as a researcher and as a group of researchers, we're very interested in finishing the research, and sometimes there's a bit remiss in our invoice or the time recording. It's a purely technical issue, and certainly we appreciate it's something that it's just a known culture within the organization. The CEO will ask us, please check your invoice, please check your time recording, or the CFO. And it's just a constant practice of in the organization for us to ensure that we're on track in terms of time recording and invoicing. And to date, I've never known anybody not get a salary or feel that they're not going to get a salary to take at any time.
Chair, with respect to move on this, because it's a reflection on me of a leadership of an institution that is on top of me. A leadership of an institution that is able to then sensitize people of the work that they are to do. And I think, as members of parliament, we may have a problem. People may come to us, I have a problem with that. But I think we must have that ability of when they were explained, understand that. Because it would have been wrong of the office of the CEO not to communicate, not to sensitize. It would have been wrong. And here we are sitting with an institution and this leadership that is, for me, have an ability of providing, and in that cost of providing leadership, these people may be uncomfortable or whatever. So I'm saying, I don't want to offend the members here, but I do think that I'm saying I want to comment before we close this meeting that the entities of science and technology, I'm so hope that other entities in other departments can come and get a tune and say how best can we copy from you in doing this stuff. What all of them is leadership. Is and when the report and the response that we're getting are giving us a reflection that the leadership in that institution, I think we must appreciate that. And I'm not just saying that.
I think that, it's a number is not clarified. I think it's the number of the right to get clarification. I think it's committed to clarification for everyone. I think they're clarified now with a lot of members. And I think it's very, very good that we can clarify, but nobody knows to get this question. I don't remember. But I think now, before next clarification, if there's anything, then they can contact the CEO directly or that class. It's not in that kind of explanation.
I'd like to thank you for that intervention. I mean, it's not about undermining the HSRC, but it's about, I think one can understand, especially in the economic recession, especially as we come to the end of the year, December, everybody wants to have their salary. So in that context, I want the clarity, and I'm quite glad that I got it. And then okay. People calling me that opportunity, you know, and this is my colleague, but then that's what we are here to do.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Sorry, you were still continuing with your response there.
On the question of training your increase for the legacy, let me say that if you look at the page 209 from the 2008, you'll see in terms of the list of executives, we lost a number of executives, you know, before year end for a variety of reasons. And when we lost them, we then did not spend as much money in 2008 as we did in 2009. And in 2009, there were also salary increases. And those salary increases that you will see are a result of negotiation with the union. In fact, our salary increase was much lower than what was obtained for comparable partners. It was about 7.8% increase. So it wasn't really so, you know, huge, but the combination of the loss in 2008 and the increase in 2009 indicates that. Now, even the salary of CEO at the moment is actually you know, affected by whatever salary increases that are negotiated, you know, for that. Well, now I've requested the board to actually change the process of salary negotiation for the executive so that there be a council remuneration committee, which the previous council has actually approved, and that means that our salary is not actually be tied to the salary increase staff, because that will help us in terms of negotiations to feel that our managers don't have a conflict of interest before by current institutions are concerned. The performance management that the council has put in is evidence based in the sense that it's a performance indicator driven. They set up the target, we agreed to the target with the chair of council at the beginning of the year. And then, you know, we agree on what it is that's going to be delivered. And when that time for performance evaluation comes, we look at it to say, have you achieved it, have you not achieved it, or not. And so the benefit, and that gets back in the process, you know, to the council itself in terms of performance. And then the chair also, at the end of the period, asks the board in terms of, you know, your assessment of how this has gone, and you know, take that into account in terms of determining how much we should do. And then the other issue that was asked was the funding, you know, that they have received to be able to conduct research on any of the aspects of the NHR or it's from JCDCZ as well as from the Gates Foundation. So we did receive a grant from them, you know, to be able to do the kind of work that we actually did. And then on the developmental stage, what were the costs associated with the colloquium on the developmental stage? I don't think I put those figures on top of my head, but I'm sure you'll be able to find it somewhere in the report. I don't know whether that report from the developmental stage colloquium, you know, how much that was, but I'm sure it's not, you know, it's some of that. That's a meeting that was held in Pretoria that involved a number of government departments, starting with the presidency, and it also included the NGOs, as well as some scientists, to come and unpack this whole concept, what is the development of space. And as I indicated earlier, the priorities of the HSRC are linked very closely with the priorities of government. And that government is led by a ruling party, and that ruling party is the ANC. So you find a lot of commonality between what the ANC says, between what the government says, and between what the different countries actually do. The planning process requires that we take into account the priorities of government as articulated. So whenever there is a State of the Nation speech, we are listening carefully in terms of what are the things that we need to add onto our own program. And then affordable health care, I agree with the member that that affordable health care is the function of the whole lot of things. If the question was affordable health care, I would have answered it comprehensively. However, I was not answering the question of affordable health care. But let me say, in terms of affordable health care, clearly is that we have to have physical infrastructure that is appropriate for the services that are to be delivered. Secondly, we must have the human resources to be able to deliver them. Unfortunately, we are now in a situation where most of our doctors, most of our specialists are actually in the private sector, serving 15% of the population that has got medical aid. The remaining 85% has to do with whatever is the left over. And that to us is a problem. And that is why the scientists, we are saying that that imbalance is what at the root of poverty. You cannot access the services in the public sector when that public sector does not have the human resources that you actually need. You therefore have long lines where people wait in long queues to get care because we don't have enough doctors to be able to provide the care. If today you said you wanted to see an ophthalmologist, you are unlikely to get it in the public sector. You are likely to get it in the private sector. So people are now going to take up money from their pockets and be able to access those services. And then, of course, there are other issues that relate to funding of healthcare. Funding of healthcare over the last, from 2006, I mean from 1996 to 2006, that funding has actually dipped. Consequently, 80,000 homes that are supposed to be filled were not filled. The consequences of that is poor quality of health services. So it is a combination of those factors, and I agree with the member that one cannot look at just one thing, but it's a combination of those things that have actually led us to be where we are in terms of poor quality of services. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I think time has now come to almost a short period.
Just
Sorry?
I'm not researching on
the language. Oh, you want to get him on the phone with the
okay. Thank you.
They would not have clean records that they didn't know what they do.
And that is why I always leave them. If there is any good one of it, it could not have been invested. The AD could not make it. There are a whole lot of aspects there to be sure that things have been done correctly. And well, I have interacted with these people since 2004, and I know that they really keep their story. And that's why I allow them to expand, because I know they will satisfy my love. I want members who live there knowing that we are not playing in hiding in God. And I think that is what it has to deliver to me. Okay. Thank you very much. But we have taken very much cognizance of the challenge that you have raised, which I think should be noted on the report of the committee, which is one, the problem of grants leading into all the issues that have been throughout our session here, that is another thing, and also the question of the specific country to be really considered, you know, and correct. Those are very important. That is exactly where the role of Parliament is. When you come to present your annual report, we have to know what will be difficulties, because Parliament, we are not police. We are here to assist so that we usher the correct direction for the people which you were mandated for. And so, whenever you come to Parliament, and people shouldn't feel uncomfortable when they are being interrogated for clarification, because of course that is also the duty of Parliament to interrogate and to get clarification. So that things do not go here out of this room to discuss that these people have not been able to answer our questions, because then it has against very, very well deserved effort of the whole year. And then if people are not satisfied, they walk out here. They will say anyone to address our questions. But you know, when we walk out here, we know that there is no question that was not properly answered. And so over all the stuff. And therefore I hope that you will always continue with the culture of doing things correctly as you have done in 2004 and prepare your reports mainly and be able to be accountable.
The is a monograph that the University of Southampton on the Commission of Fire Learning, and the title has the word commanding with it, because it's trying to read on that reasonably explained. It is on the HRC website, so it's a whole big report. With regard to the shorter paper that was commissioned by the Department of Education, I can just find out whether it's confidential and important that we can share. The paper, it was delivered last in November. At the end of November, the Department of Education had a two-day workshop and seminar on the recognition of higher learning. I found out about where that paper has been done already. But the whole book is on the website.
And your audience
is right. Is that
a new question or a
comment? Just this is a committee housekeeping thing that I'd like to raise, but nothing to do with grounding. Chair, at our previous last week's meeting, you mentioned that our colleague here had actually been to the space conference in South Korea. Been told us that someone had actually gone. And my piece is, I don't know if the committee structure has got no obligation to, but whether we could either have a written report or plan for the beginning of next year, we should just give a quick overview of what she did and share her experiences with us. I would appreciate that.
Well, that is the parliamentary program. You see, everybody has got the editors, has got to give a report, even ourselves, got to give a report as we went to Copenhagen. Recently in Washington, so it's a very good recruitment for any troops. It's just that now we don't have time because every next day we will combine what's going on.
Chair, just for the benefit, I appreciate the concern, but there is something that is needed to report to be delayed. secretary who came, who wanted us for the station, in house of point of address, the computer was stolen, now we see it in the temple.
No, there is one in the last election. But any matter will post all that is the document of the committee, and accordingly will take it to the House for adoption. Are we going to finish? Okay. Is this also a follow-up?
No, it's not a follow-up. This is our last meeting for the term, I take it. And I'd like to make it on record. I'm saying that going all the attorney meetings in a very collegial manner. Even though we may defer on certain items, and try to wish all our members, including you, a peaceful and a gift of recess. We come back to a very hard work next year. And then, just for housekeeping purposes, is this committee going to sit in the last week of January? I would appreciate candidate notice on that. The committee needs, I think, start on the 21st of January.
Okay, thank you very much. I really forgot that this is our last meeting, actually. Honorable Member, I really should have allowed everybody to say a word about this. Myself, on behalf of the committee, I wish all members of the committee very, very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year and a safe, good 2022 before Christmas. And I also sent a similar message to all our entities that have worked with us throughout this year. And we hope that next year we will all be together without any grief, and we will continue our work at home. I'd like also some members to also, for the way the members set up in our place, also other members to have similar platforms. Let's just go by go. Let's go next and then I'm not going to change that.
Thank you. Yes, this is basically everybody can have a good break. Come back with you latest races and many of this for a prime time. And yeah, so this is our good.
I think I'm going to have four things. First, we want to say we are closing the tent with some excitement and confidence that institutions that are there to ensure that we are able to provide leadership to our society, we are able to do that and also to have a to be part of the oversight that we are to do. We want to say thank you very much for that. I want to say about the women's London of Christmas. In the camp, we are still not even standing outside in our country, but we must rest so that we ensure that in blessing we read this book and come back next day being empowered. And again, I'm saying that children and children are still not the same.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm not watching, I want to remind you that we still have the public hearing, so it's a bit. Huh? Oh, that's the program.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't know that. Thank you very much. Have a very Merry Christmas.
Thank you.
We will have myself, I will be working in my consultation.
What do you prefer?
Huh? Yeah.